Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and this is Louise Erdrich, who's from Wahpeton.
There was no imaginative depth to anything until I really began to write about where I was from, and then that something just began for me, something clicked, and I could hear what people would say, and I knew how the world would look and how it would smell, and everything that we take for granted being here became very alive for me.
If you stick around to listen, you can hear her talk about sense of place and borders and a puppy charming its way out of getting eaten, about her hopes for her daughter's little blue eyeglasses.
Above all, little blue eyeglasses. Train her eyes upon the truth and let her eyes rest in the truth and help her see within the truth the strength to bear the truth.
And also, you can hear her talk about language and writing and distraction. This is Prairie Public Presents. Every Sunday at 5 p.m. Central Time, we bring up things that don't fit into the regular weekly schedule. And today, it's Louise Erdrich. She's a widely honored and widely read author. When the discussion coming up was recorded, she had just published The Roundhouse, for which she won the National Book Award, and she reads from it a little here. She's of Ojibwe and German ancestry, and this fact shows up in almost all of her writings. Maybe you've seen Love Medicine, or The Beet Queen, or The Miracles at Little No Horse, or Plague of Doves, or The Master Butcher's Singing Club, just to name a few, or her most recent, Future Home of the Living God. What you're going to hear today took place on the stage at Bluestem in Moorhead at an event sponsored by the North Dakota Humanities Council. Interviewing Louise is writer Jameson Reidenauer, and he starts off talking about where she's from.
She was raised in Wahpeton, North Dakota.
Yay!
And have various family members here tonight. I know at least her sister, Lise, who Louise told me is a genius, is here, and I'm supposed to say she's a genius from the stage. Let's officially welcome, she's been sitting in front of you, but Louise Erdrich.
Thank you.
It's good to meet you. You know, part of the theme of what we're talking about over these 2 days is identity and place, or how identity is tied to place. And that seems a particularly apt theme for the body of your work across your entire career, much of which takes place I've often heard it compared to Faulkner, and I knew I was going to have to probably pronounce Yalquapatamba, Faulkner's town. I even practiced it, but I'm not going to try.
Let's just see if there's anybody who can pronounce it in the audience. It's not Yuknapatak. So, there we go.
There we go. Excellent. Thank you very much. So maybe we could begin with that, talking a little bit about the role of place in your work.
Well, obviously we're from a very special and distinctive place, and it's something that everyone here, everybody shares this. Otherwise, you wouldn't really be here if you didn't have a place in your heart, right? So everyone does. I'm going to assume that that's something we all have in common somehow. And I think it's a very human, it's part of what makes us human, is to have formed an attachment somewhere on this earth. And for me, because I grew up in Wahpeton, it's Wahpeton in the Red River Valley. I really didn't leave until I went to college. So I didn't even feel, I didn't feel the loss for many years. But then I began to realize that there was something wrong with not being able to see the horizon, feeling like the weather sneaked up on you. You know, you never knew if it was going to storm. It was suddenly there. It wasn't like here where you can just look out and you know what's going to happen in the sky. And so the landscape itself, I think, is what was most important to me growing up as a kid. and then the sense of freedom that I also had. And I think that's part of this particular place. I notice when my parents, who still live in Wapton, have their grandchildren come back from places like the Twin Cities, they feel an immediate sense of freedom in that they can ride their bicycles all through town. They can go to places they need to go. They can fend for themselves. And I always felt like that. And I think that tied me to place as well.
Was that a conscious decision then, that I'm going to write about this? Did you just find one day I seem to be going back here again and again in my writing?
Oh no. So I left here and I went to college, and I thought I wanted to be an expatriate. I wanted to get away, for God, you know. I wanted to get away. So I went and I tried writing about everywhere else I could think of, and nothing really made sense to me or was imaginatively, there was no imaginative depth to anything until I really began to write about where I was from, and then that something just began for me, something clicked, and I could hear what people would say, and I knew how the world would look and how it would smell, and everything that we take for granted being here became very alive for me. Part of it was a piece of longing. I didn't live here at that time. And so I wanted to be home. It was homesickness, I think, that first started me really writing about home.
And then that obviously worked, and because you came back to it. And you're writing more about, because that is the setting, that is the what ties it down, but you're clearly working with more than that. You're working with cultural issues. You're working with social issues in this area. How do you feel that? I mean, and obviously it translates, and I'm very interested in that and how that specificity of place and specificity of social issue and specificity of situation strikes a chord with a national or worldwide audience, people that have never thought about or been to North Dakota, where it's just sort of a hypothetical place up at the top of the map, but they identify with things that you're writing about. Can you speak about that?
Well, I can't speak to whether people do or don't identify, but I think every book that other people want to read has a very specific place that it talks about and very human emotions that go far and wide and describe the landscape and the outer landscape of what it's like to be a person among many other people and the inner landscape of the soul. I mean, I think there's something that translates to others wherever a piece of literature is set. And many of the books that I write have to do with either Native American people or Ojibwe people, but a mixture of non-Native and Native. And I think that's, you know, this is a very apt subject for our border theme. And we were just looking up here at our border states control booth. I just feel like somebody's watching us up in there. I don't know who it is, and I don't really. Well, there's a nice man in a striped shirt. He looks harmless. It's probably fine. It's no problem. But you know, I think this is going to be an increasingly vital subject, because not only are we intermarrying, not only are we mixing our backgrounds, but we're also in an age in which our exploding human population is going to have trouble with where borders are physically on this earth. And I don't mean physically as if you can see them, of course, but where they are set politically. I mean the political borders on the earth.
That might be this. I'm trying to not make this a ham-fisted segue, but that it might be a natural place for you to talk a little bit about your work with Native American language preservation.
Well, you know, I hesitate to say that I'm really involved at this point because I haven't practiced for weeks. I just practice in little bursts. And usually in the winter, I'm immersed in more of a weekly setting in which everybody talks Ojibwe. And I feel like I'm more in the language, in language work. My oldest daughter has become an immersion camp director, and it's very hard to run a camp in which people suddenly come in and are speaking, trying very hard to speak Ojibwe, but they suddenly come into a camp and are, one of the rules is you get your cell phones taken away, you get every electronic device taken away, and you converse only in Ojibwe from that point on. So it is like being immersed in a foreign country with wonderful people, but having only the most rudimentary forms of communication at your disposal at first. And people break down within the week and they are crying. Language is that important to us. The ability to express ourselves is that vital to us. And when we are not able to speak of something deeper than what we want for breakfast or dinner and the weather, we start crying and we can't stand it. And that's something that I really didn't know, but she told me how hard it was for people, just the difficulty, and people have to surmount that in order to continue on with the Ojibwe language into a more complex and deep form of communication.
Do you write in Ojibwe?
I write words in Ojibwe, and I interject texts in Ojibwe, which I have somebody else check. No, because I do not pretend to have more of a facility in Ojibwe than a 3 or 4 year old. Really, it's
right.
I have no real language.
Sure.
Yeah, but I love this. You can love the study of a language and work at it and continue on with it and make it a lifelong effort, and that's what Ojibwe is for me. It's a lifelong effort, and I hope I get to the point where I can make a joke or even get a joke sometime.
I'm fascinated by that idea, and I've done some work with Noella McDonnell, the Irish poet who refuses to write in anything but Irish Gaelic.
Right.
Even though she then has to have an English translation next to it for anybody to be able to read it, but it's to her very important. Do you know her essay, the Corpse That Sits Up and Talks Back, about the Irish language,
right.
in which she talks about how closely it's tied to her identity, just like you're saying, that even if there's only this small group of people that still use this language on a practical level, that she's not being true to who she is or where she's from if she writes in, that for her, the language of the colonizer.
Well, that's a very interesting point of view, and I think it is true that Ojibwe, when you really begin to take it in and really truly begin to study it, it does begin to change a person's outlook. Part of Ojibwe's mystery is that it has so many verbs and so few nouns. I mean, I guess that isn't really a mystery. This is a language that's so based on action and doing that, of course, it has myriad numbers of verbs to how to do things. But the wonderful thing about the verbs are that you can conjugate them hundreds of ways and it has to do, the conjugations have to do with the configurations of people who are doing the things. So the language is about relationships and action. And there are so few nouns as compared to our, lingua franca, English, which seems loaded with nouns. I mean, what are we? We're a people of nouns, of stuff, right? Yeah. I guess we are. But this...
It makes sense culturally when you think about it.
Yeah. Culturally, it does. But it is, like, you know, English also is a gift to a writer because of its amazing... the facility one has in adding other languages, and these indeed are colonized languages, but you can add to it in any way you want, you know. There are fewer rules in as to what you can add in English, and indeed it's a thrill to break the rules.
Yeah. Once you know them. Sorry,
if you don't know them.
I know. But I tell my students.
Right, well, you have to know them
first.
But
the rules are supposed to be broken. Like,
yeah.
But you don't know the rules yet.
Right.
You are listening to author Louise Erdrich, widely considered one of the leading authors of the Native American Renaissance, interviewed by Jameson Ridenour on stage in Bluestem in Moorhead. This event was sponsored and organized by the North Dakota Humanities Council. Their next big event like this is the Game Changer Symposium on October 13th, next fall. It will be live streamed. Of course, you can go to it in person. It'll be in Bismarck. It features Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, about raising unusual children, and Rebecca Skloot, the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. According to Brenna Gerhardt at the Humanities Council, it's going to be epic. That's next October. The Game Changer Symposium. You can see more about that if you go to the North Dakota Humanities Council website, ndhumanities.org. Back to Louise Erdrich and Jameson Ridenour here on Prairie Public.
Could you read something for us?
Yeah, I will. I have a ton of books in here that I've got.
If you would like to hear her read, we can just keep talking. But would you like to hear her read something?
Well, let's see. I brought the next book. I brought a book that, somebody wants me to read in the voice of a dog. Is there a dog back there?
It's right here in the front.
See, I heard, there is a piece in the voice of a dog. All right, where is the dog? Okay. Okay, I'll read in the voice of a dog for a minute. All right. I'm not going to sound like a dog, but this is a dog. It's called Almost Soup. Almost Soup. A dog's eye view of history includes certain details that human people might rather skip. I have no illusions. Humans are capable of anything. For instance, you could end up puppy soup if you're born a pure white dog on the reservation, unless you're one who is extra clever like me. I survived into my old age through dog magic. That's right. You see me, you see the result of dog wit, dog skill, medicine ways I learned from my elders and want to pass on now to my relatives, wherever that dog is. You. Listen up, Anamushug. You're only going to get this knowledge from the real dog's mouth once. There's a little coyote in me, just a touch here in my paws, bigger than a dog's paws. My jaw, too, strong to snap rabbit bones. Prairie dog bones as well. That's right, prairie. I don't mind saying to you that I am not a full-blood Ojibwe reservation dog. No, I'm part Dakota, born out in Bon Aking, transported here just after I opened my eyes, and I still remember all that sky, all that pure space, all that blowing dirt of land where I got my name, which has since become legendary. Here is how it happened. I was underneath the house one hot, slow day, panting in the dirt. I was a young thing, just chubby too, and like I said, white all over. And that worried my mother. Every morning she scratched dirt on me, threw me in the mud, rolled me in the garbage to disguise my purity. Her words to me were this: "My son, you won't survive if you lick your paws. Don't be respectable." Us Indian dogs have to look as unappetizing as we can. Slink a little, won't you? Stick your ears out. Grow ticks, fleas. Bite your fur here and there. Strive for a disreputable appearance, my boy. Above all, don't be clean. Like I say, born pure white, you usually don't stand a chance. But me, I took my mama's advice. After all, I was the son of a blend of dogs stretching back to the beginning of time on this continent. We sprang up here. We had no need to cross on any land bridge. We know who we are. Us, we are descended of original dog. I think about her lots, about my ancestor from a way back, the dog named Sorrow who drank a human's milk. I think about her because I know it was that first dog's hand-me-down wit that saved my life that time they were boiling up the sacred soup. I hear these words. Get under the house, Melvin. Fetch that white puppy now. Bam! My mama throws me in the furthest house corner and sits down on me. I cover up with her, but once Melvin is in play distance, I can't help it. I've got that curious streak of all the Indian dogs. I peek right around my mother's tail and whoops, he's got me. He drags me out and gives me to a grandma who stuffs me in a gunny sack and slings me down beside the fire. I fight that bag for a while, but it's warm and cozy, and I go to sleep. I don't think much of it, just another human habit I'll get used to, this stuffing dogs in sacks. Then I hear them talking. Sharpen up the knife, Grandma's voice. That's a nice fat white puppy, somebody else. You'll make a good soup for the ceremony, but do you think enough to go around? Should we kill another one? Then, right above me, they start arguing about whether or not I'd feed 20. Me, just a little chunk of a guy. Gawin, no, I bark. No, no, no. I'm not enough for even 5 of you strong warrior sons. Anyway, no, I'm sour meat. I don't want to be eaten. And in response, I get this tap from the grandma's shoe. Just a tap. But all us dogs know feet language. Be quiet or you'll get a solid one, it means. So I shut up. And once I stop barking, all I can do is think, and I think fast. I think furious. I think desperate puppy thoughts until I know what I'll do the minute they let me out. A puppy has just one weapon, and there's only one word for it but puppiness. Stuck in that bag, I muster all my puppiness. I call my tail wags and love licks up from deep way back. From the dogs going back to dogs onto the beginning of our association with these predictable and exasperating beings called humans. I hear them stroking steel on steel. I hear them tapping the boiling water pot. I hear them deciding I'll be enough, just barely. Then, daylight, the bag loosens and the grandma draws me forth, and just quick, because I'm smart, desperate, and connected with my ancestors, I look for the nearest girl child. In the bunch around me, I spot her. I pick her out. She's sitting with a cousin playing and not noting me at all. I give a friendly little whine, a yap. And then, as the grandma hauls me toward the table, a sharp, loud bark of fear that starts out of me. I can't help it, but good thing, because the girl hears it and responds. Grandma, she says, what you gonna do with that puppy? Mumbles grandma. Gabashim, 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 mumbles grandma. The way they do when they're trying to hide their actions. What? That gets up her little girl curiosity, a trait us dogs and children share in equal parts. What makes us love each other so? Don't you know, you dummy, shouts the boy cousin in boy knowledge. Grandma's going to boil it up into soup. Hey, my girl says, shy and laughing, Grandma wouldn't do that. And she holds out her hands for me, which is when I use my age-old original dog puppiness. I throw puppy love at her in loopy yo-yos, puppy drool, joy, and big pod puppy clabber, ear perks, eye contact. Most of all, the potent weapon of all puppies, the head cock and puppy grin. Gimme him, gimme. No, says Grandma, holding me tight and pursing her lips in that terrible way of grandmas when they cannot be swayed. But she's dealing with her own descendant in its purest form. Pure, puppy-loving girl. Grandma, 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 she shrieks. Hey, give me the puppy, give me the puppy, give me the puppy. Now it's time for me to wiggle all over and give the high quotient adorability that all puppies know. This is life or death. I do it double time, triple time, full of puppy determination, desperate to live. Ooh, says another grandma, sharp-eyed, quick, throw him in the pot. No, says yet another, she wants that puppy bad, her. Give her that little dog, says a grandpa. Now his grandpa heart swelling up, she wants that dog. So give her that little dog. That is pretty much how it goes all the time now these days. I have even heard grandmas have softened their hearts for us, and we Indian dogs are safe as anywhere on earth, which isn't saying much. Now my girl's doll playing fingers are brushing my fur. She's jumping for me, spinning like a sweet maple seed, straining up toward Grandma, who at this point can't hold on to me without looking almost supernaturally mean. And so it is I feel those ancient dog cooking fingers give me up before her disappointed voice does, here. And just like that, I'm in the most heavenly of places. Soft, strong girl arms. I'm carried off to be played with and petted, fed scraps, dragged around in a baby carriage made of an old shoebox, dressed in the clothing of tiny brothers and sisters. Oh, yes, I'll do anything, anything. This is when my naming happens. As we go off, I hear that grandpa calling behind us in amusement, asking the name of that puppy, me. And my girl calls back without hesitation, the name I will bear from then on into my age, the name that has given so many of our breedless breed hope, the name that I will live on in dogness down through the generations. You've heard it, you know it. Almost soup.
That's wonderful.
I just want to say, nobody really makes puppy soup. This is written a long time ago.
That's from The Antelope Wife?
Yeah.
That really feels like the voice of a dog. That's really amazing how you channeled that. Like I can.
Oh, the dog. Yeah. We always have dogs.
We do too.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
Well, now I'm working on a book that is, I hope, going to incorporate some of my daughter's My daughter, Aza, is a graphic novelist, so I'm working on stories that include some of her drawings in between the stories. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I know. That's going to be really cool. I'm excited. Yeah.
Working between media.
Yeah.
And you work, you're also, I mean, we've been talking largely about your fiction. You have 3 collections of poetry as well. Do you have any, just thinking about craft now as a writer, how do you decide if an idea is going to be a poem or a piece of prose? Do you lean in one direction or another? Do you have a
maybe I'll read a poem, because I don't really know when things are going to be poems, but sometimes I'll start writing and it'll just turn into a poem without. It's not without effort, but it will become obvious to me that it's going to be a poem. This is one that I wrote for Aza. And Aza used to have, when she was a little girl, she wore a pair of little blue eyeglasses. And this is about girls growing up and how, well, you'll know by the end how it is that girls need to see deeper and deeper into life as they get to be young women. Little blue eyeglasses. I give you the honored task of assisting my youngest daughter in her work, which is to see not only general shapes, but specific details and minute variations in the color and texture of objects ranging from immense ocean sky to very tiny and vertebrate hidden at the edge of carpet. Little blue eyeglasses, I charge you with the solemn responsibility of depth perception. Guide her steps through dim corridors. Allow her to charge down the staircase into my arms without injury. Above all, little blue eyeglasses, train her eyes upon the truth and let her eyes rest in the truth and help her see within the truth the strength to bear the truth.
It's nice. It's almost like a prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. Ed, yeah, I think so. Let her eyes, train her eyes upon the truth. Let her eyes rest in the truth. Help her see within the truth the strength to bear the truth. Yeah, I've thought about that many times. It's not as though I even wrote that. It's, that's the thing about poems. Sometimes it seems as though they come from some other place, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they come from some other place. Should I read this one?
Yes, please.
All right, this is from some other place. This is from some other place. You'll know why it's from some other place, because I can just see that some of you will understand that there is some other place that sometimes tells you this. Advice to myself, leave the dishes. Let the celery rot in the bottom drawer of the refrigerator and an earthen scum harden on the kitchen floor. Leave the black crumbs in the bottom of the toaster. Throw the cracked bowl out and don't patch the cup. Don't patch anything. Don't mend. Buy safety pins. Don't even sew on a button. Let the wind have its way. Then the earth that invades as dust, and then the dead foaming up in gray rolls underneath the couch. Talk to them. Tell them they are welcome. Don't keep all the pieces of the puzzles or the doll's tiny shoes in pairs. Don't worry who uses whose toothbrush or if anything matches, anything at all, except one word to another or a thought. Pursue the authentic. Decide first what is authentic, then go after it with all your heart. Your heart, that place you don't even think of cleaning out, that closet stuffed with savage mementos. Don't sort the paper clips from screws from saved baby teeth, or worry if we're all eating cereal for supper again. Don't answer the telephone. Ever, or weep over anything that breaks. Pink molds will grow within those sealed cartons in the refrigerator. Accept new forms of life. And talk to the dead, who drift in through the screened windows, who collect patiently on the tops of food jars and books. Recycle the mail. Don't read it, don't read anything, except what destroys the insulation between yourself and your experience, or what pulls down, or strikes at, or what shatters this ruse you call necessity. So if you start cleaning, you know, just take that poem out. Really. Women, men, anyone who cleans.
Just hang it on the wall in the living room just as a reminder. I think it should be a cross-stitch sampler, I think. In
people. I know. Sometimes I find myself cleaning instead of writing, and I think, where is that poem? It's not in me.
It's come from somewhere else.
It came from somewhere else. Where is that person?
But it's fascinating to hear you read, particularly to hear you read poetry back-to-back with prose, because I feel like your prose has a poetic quality to it, and I don't necessarily mean that in the grand manner, but just in the sense of attention to rhythm and attention to the sound of the words, in a way that prose writers don't often have, and I assume that moving back and forth between genre, I assume some of it is just naturally the way you write, but I would guess that there's some facility that comes from being fluid between the forms.
Well, it may, because I did start as a poet, and I know that whenever I got stuck, I would kind of go back to poetry, you know. I would wait for the sound. If I couldn't think of the where a story went, where the narrative went, I'd wait for a sound to pick me up.
Check the time real quick.
What's the chime? Sure. Time?
Yeah, because we've actually been talking about 40 minutes, believe it or not.
Well, okay. I have one more thing I'm supposed to read. I could read the first bit of this.
You're welcome to read. I can listen to you read all night, so you're welcome to read.
I could read this.
Yeah.
Or else we could just talk.
No, why don't you read that? Well, we have time to, I've set aside time to take questions, so why don't you read from this, and then Brenna has a couple of announcements, and we'll take up questions by then, and we'll do a Q&A after that. Does that work?
That works. I'm just going to read. This is about 4 or 5 minutes. This is from this book, The Roundhouse. It's about the difficulty. It's about a boy and his mother and his relationship with her. And it's the question in this story, which is set in 1988, is whether this boy will have to take on the act of justice that grown-ups cannot take on, whether he's going to be able to save his mother and find justice for her. This is a story that's put together of many stories, and it's put together because, we can talk about this later, you might have questions, but it is so very difficult to prosecute rape on reservations. Up till this day, it is even more difficult. But this starts in a very soft way, really, an unsuspecting way. Small trees had attacked my parents' house at the foundation. They were just seedlings with one or two rigid, healthy leaves. Nevertheless, the stocky shoots had managed to squeeze through knife cracks in the decorative brown shingles. They had grown into the unseen wall, and it was difficult to pry them loose. My father, a judge, wiped his palm across his forehead and damned their toughness. I was using a rusted old dandelion fork that he wielded, a long, slim fireplace poker that was probably doing more harm than good. As my father prodded away blindly, he was surely making convenient holes where he sensed roots might have penetrated, and he was probably making these holes in the mortar for next year's seedlings. Whenever I succeeded in working loose a tiny tree, I placed it like a trophy beside me on the narrow sidewalk. I thought it a wonder that the treelets had persisted through a North Dakota winter. It had water, but only feeble light and a few crumbs of earth, yet each seed had managed to sink the hasp of a root deep in a probing tendril outward. My father stood, stretching his sore back. "That's enough," he said, though he was usually a perfectionist. I had quit at last. I was reading and drinking a cool glass of water in the kitchen when my father came out of his nap and entered, disoriented and yawning. For all its importance, the book that I was reading was not heavy, and when he appeared, I drew it quickly into my lap. My father licked his dry lips and cast about, searching for the smell of food or the sound of pots or the clinking of glasses. What he said then surprised me, though on the face of it, his words seemed slight. "Where is your mother?" I slid the book onto another chair and handed him my glass of water. He gulped it down. He didn't say those words again, but the two of us stared at each other in the way that struck me somehow as adult, as though he knew that by reading his book, I'd inserted myself into his world. His look persisted until I dropped my eyes. I'd actually just turned 13. 2 weeks ago, I'd been 12. "At work?" I said. I knew she was not really at work. She'd answered a phone call and then told me she was going into her office to pick up a folder. It was Sunday, thus the hush, the Sunday afternoon suspension. Even if she'd gone to her sister's house to visit, she would have returned by now to start dinner. We both knew that. Women don't realize how much store men set on the regularity of their habits. We absorb their comings and goings into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones, our pulse is set to theirs. And as always, on a weekend afternoon, we were waiting for my mother to start us ticking away on the evening. And so, you see, her absence stopped time. And so it will stop time for them. Nothing will be the same after.
Thank you very much, Louise. Lovely. Will your future writing include more on the history of North Dakota? How so?
Well, I never expect that the writing will include pieces of history of North Dakota, but I seem to go back and become fascinated with little chunks of history. I mean, I'm not a researcher, I'm not a historian. So when some little detail hits me, I can't get it out of my mind. For instance, this book, The Plague of Doves, really did. It was a true incident, and doves really, they were really passenger pigeons. But we couldn't say a plague of pigeons. didn't sound as.
Wasn't quite as poetic, was it?
No.
Yeah. Here's a couple about craft. So I'll read them both together. One is, could you describe your writing process? What are your idiosyncratic ways of drafting and revising? What advice could you give to a young writer? And the second one is, how do you conquer writer's block? Do you set aside time to write, or do you just let it happen when it happens?
Well, I usually try to leave the dishes and go upstairs, and I write in the, I guess it would be the attic of the house, but it's an upstairs. And I write for as long as I possibly can without distractions, and I write by hand. At first, of course, it was because I was a poet and I always wrote by hand. But now I'm finding that it's almost impossible to write on a computer without checking your email. So, you know, I can't write on a computer. I don't get anything done. So I do have to write by hand. There's a good reason for it now. Huh. Leave the computer behind and just write by hand. I mean, I don't know how anybody writes on a computer without.
There's a new program. Another writer was telling me about it that shuts off. You set it the timer, and it shuts your internet off, and so you can't, like, for an hour and a half or however long you set it. You physically are unable to get on the internet, so you have to write. It's kind of cool. It seems like it's easier to pick up a pen, but this guy was telling me.
It seems sad. But no, it's no different. You know, when I first started, I was a poet, and I first started writing, and I found that I couldn't sit still. That was one of my problems in sustaining a narrative. So I, that was a little child. I thought I heard a dog. That was a little kid all this time. I was reading to a child.
There's a dog there as well.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad. Oh, my God. But I did. I had a scarf, and I tied myself into my chair. And then I would have to. It's sort of the same thing. I would have to untie myself of these knots in order to get. Because I used to get up and sit. You know, I couldn't sit still.
It would have to be intentional about stopping if you were going to stop.
Right. I couldn't just stop and get up. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. It helped.
How long does it take on average to write a book?
Well, a lot of the pieces of a book will have been now that I have a friend here from my 40th high school reunion. So I've been writing just about since, you know, 30 years. I can go back 30 years and use pieces that I've had for 30 years in ongoing books. So I never really throw away pieces of writing. And it's hard to tell how much time a book really takes because of that. Sometimes I go back and use pieces that have been there forever, you know, for the length of my writing life.
Sure.
But then the effort of a book is maybe, you know, the all-out effort is 2 or 3, 4 years.
One asks, at what age were you conscious of coming from multiple heritages, and have you ever felt that you were not Indian enough? And the second one is, how has your German-American heritage influenced your life and input into your writing?
Those are all interesting questions about being a mixture of different backgrounds, which I think is becoming more and more common until, you know, thank God it will soon become a cliche, and maybe it has already, you know. Because I can't remember when I didn't know that this was my own background. And I've sometimes felt that it didn't matter and sometimes felt it mattered. What it really is for me as a writer is a gift, because I think it's a gift to always be a bit at the margin of things and to somehow feel an observer more than someone who is automatically accepted anywhere. I don't think I was accepted anywhere truly more because of my personality than as anybody I really was. But I don't know, I guess that's an answer of sorts, yeah.
Tell us about your bookstore.
Oh, my bookstore is Birchbark Books, and it's, you can look it up online, and it's at birchbarkbooks.com. Our dogs recommend books. We have a dog blog, and our dogs are good readers. Dogs are welcome in our bookstore. We have a bookstore dog, and we are focused on Native American books, but we're a general bookstore, and I don't know why we're surviving. It may be because we're by the only nude beach in Minneapolis, and you know.
That's good to know.
Yeah, we're on the way, and right down the road, but nobody even goes nude in Minnesota. It's really disappointing. Yeah.
It's so embarrassing.
It's really.
So went to a place I wasn't expecting to go today.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go. Any question you ask, I've just decided I'm going to go somewhere.
Sure.
I'm going to go somewhere else.
A couple of questions about Master Butcher Singing Club in particular. One person wants to know how you came up with the title, and another one just says it's one of their favorite books, and could you talk about what inspired it?
Well, I'm so glad that someone's favorite book, because I had a great question that was on the... We were doing a Prairie Public Television show, and someone said, God, this is a depressing book, and everyone in my book club is just so depressed over it, and what can you say? And I didn't know what to say, but some people find it depressing because there's a lot of darkness, I suppose, in it, but I didn't think it was all that... I sometimes think the dark sides of things, I thought it was funny, you know. It wasn't... It was... Okay, let's go back to the beginning, where we ask about the title. The title comes from a true Master Butcher Singing Club, which my paternal grandfather, belonged to back in Germany. The guilds had singing clubs, and when he left for the U.S. in 1920, the singing clubs, the Butcher's Guild, came down to the harbor and sang to him as he left. And when he returned after the Second World War in 1954, the remaining people from that singing club got together. And so the Master Butcher's Singing Club resonated for me. It was always a title I had in my head. I like titles.
What social justice issue are you most passionate about?
I probably have to say that along with the issue I just mentioned, which is it's a question of Native people having the authority on their own national lands to administer justice to Native or non-Native people. That's something I'm very concerned with right now. I believe that there's a bill stuck right now in Congress that would enable some forms of justice to be administered to non-Native people. That was a right that was taken away from Native people, and that should be a right that people have. So this book, The Roundhouse, in some ways deals with that. But I would say that one of the most pressing issues that I care about right now is the fact that our climate is changing and we don't know how it's going to change. And so I'm very interested in green energy, in solar, wind, and how we're going to fix our addiction to oil. I don't know how it's going to happen. And God knows we're being funded, you know, by a lot of oil money in North Dakota. We're getting quite an interesting mixture of wind, solar, and oil in North Dakota. But if we take all the oil out of the ground, our climate will be dead. I mean, we'll be dead. The climate will be fine. The earth will be fine. The earth will always be, you know, it'll be fine, but we'll have ended the Holocene age. We'll have ended the age where it's easy for us to live and grow crops and sustain ourselves. So I guess my main concern right now is whether we can bear to not extract the last drop and go somewhere else for our energy.
So no joke, the next question is, with the oil boom in North Dakota, how do you see that working its way into your work?
Yeah, I don't know how I would work it in. It's an issue of political concern for me, and I don't think it's easy to write books with political bases. It's hard to do because you don't want to rant at people. You want to tell a human story. You want to tell a real story. Nobody's going to read a rant about, you know, you can read that on the internet anytime. You can read rants, you know. You want to read a story that captures you, that has love, that has sacrifice, that has, you know, as Faulkner said, valor, courage, endurance, and you know, from my point of view, darkness and joy.
Approximately what percentage of your characters are based on people you know from real life?
Well, let's see how many people in the audience. Right there, there's a few. Actually, there's a neighbor of ours in Wahpeton who is not here, darn, because he'd stand up and he'd say, they're all based on me. He's not here. I was in Seattle and he happened to be in the audience and someone asked that question and he stood up and said, they're all based on me. They're not based on real people.
That would be a handy question, though, if you could actually point to some guy and say...
Yeah, it was great. I was
him.
Wishing Tilford was in the audience, yeah. But he's not.
What is your favorite place of natural beauty in North Dakota?
Well, it's my parents' garden. My parents have a wonderful garden that is just over... It's always a work of art because it's... The squash vines are roaming, and they're harvesting one piece or another. It's a really beautiful, beautiful place to be every year. The other place is the Turtle Mountains. I love the Turtle Mountains. It's beautiful up there.
Two questions from high school teachers about motivating students. This says, as a high school English teacher, I'm challenged with the task of motivating students to empathize with those from other borders, identity, and place. If there's one thing you could say to inspire students to recognize this, what would it be? And then an earlier question I saw asked specifically about the same thing, but specifically in terms of Native American culture.
It seems to me this teacher is asking ways to help students get out of their skins. And get into other people's skins. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. I really think the only way, it's one thing literature does help people do, no question, that literature has changed people's views because when you're able to invade another person's consciousness who's very different than you, sometimes you're able to understand that person more thoroughly. But I think it's a very hard task. And it's something that would happen most easily if that teacher could just isolate her students one by one in a Native American classroom and see how it felt to be in that class, to do a class exchange of people, you know. I think that's the wonderful thing that when you're working with the humanities as the North Dakota Humanities Council is doing and encouraging young people to really grab reading and really take in reading. It's one thing to read for an assignment, and that doesn't really do it, but to grab it, read it, and find the depth and it's almost as though you need to find the core of the self in the reading. And once that starts to happen for a young person, then that imaginative leap can take place.
I think that's a wonderful place to end the evening. Thank you very much, Louise. Thank you to the North Dakota Humanities Council, and thank you all for
being
here.
Thank you for showing up. Thank you. Driving out here. What a pleasure.